the Screwtape Letters. It's the second one in the booklet. The Screwtape Letters, simply put, is a collection of 31 letters written by Screwtape, a senior devil, to his nephew Wormwood, a younger and more inexperienced devil. And Wormwood has been put in charge of guiding his patient, whose name we never learn, towards our Father below and away from the enemy. Now, if you're a devil, your enemy is God. Okay, so Wormwood, the junior devil, has been put in charge of leading his patient away from the enemy, which we call God. Okay, each letter of Screwtape to Wormwood, Screwtape signs, "Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape." Okay, let's have a show of hands. How many people have read either all or a good part of the Screwtape Letters? Okay. As I suppose, more have read the Screwtape Letters, I think, than raised their hand for the Great Divorce. The Screwtape Letters is a favorite. I have met many people who have said I've enjoyed the wit and the humor, the cleverness of the Screwtape Letters. If a person has read only one thing by C.S. Lewis, there's a pretty good chance it will be the Screwtape Letters, or maybe The Lion, the Witch, you know, and the Wardrobe, okay? So I'm going to have a few quotes from the Screwtape Letters, but you really can read them, you know, on your own, and they don't need me to hold them up. I will this morning tell you a little bit more about C.S. Lewis, and especially in relation to the Screwtape Letters, but we will be doing a few little excerpts from it. C.S. Lewis told his brother, Warning, that he got the idea for this book on a Sunday morning while attending the worship service, which makes me wonder what the sermon was about. Or makes me wonder if he was listening to the sermon or just daydreaming about what he's going to write next. Lewis said that the idea came to him, why not write a book where one devil is teaching another devil in the art and skill of temptation? And temptation here is not just to have one too many windmill cookies. That's my favorite cookies. Okay. I wish that's all we had to worry about. Wormwood is to learn how to tempt his patient away from God and Christian truth. I mean, that's the great temptation. These letters were written in 1941, but they first were not a book. They first appeared in the now-defunct news magazine, The Guardian. And Lewis was cranking out one a week for this news magazine. And then when the series finished, they were tweaked, and immediately someone brought them together and made them into what is now today the book, The Screwtape Letters. Because this book is so popular, C.S. Lewis makes a lot of comments about his Screwtape Letters. He was being asked about this all the time. An interviewer asked him, Where did you get the profound insights into temptation? I mean, it's like C.S. Lewis had been the devil, that he knows temptation, you know, so well. And I love C.S. Lewis's answer. Where did he get the profound insights into temptation? Some have paid me an undeserved compliment by supposing that my letters were the ripe fruit of many years' study in moral and ascetic theology. they forget that there is an equally reliable, though less credible, way of learning how temptation works. My heart. I need no other. My heart showeth me the wickedness of the ungodly. And here he's quoting Psalm 36. So that's how he learned about temptation. He consulted his own heart. Okay. Lewis writes these 10 years after his conversion. And it is obvious to me, at least, that he, after his conversion, frequently consulted this source of knowledge about temptation. He himself, though he had grown up in a sort of nominally Christian home, he had been drawn away, you know, from God, from Christianity into atheism, and he sort of knows what worked on him. Okay, so I think in the letters sometimes he's even referring to his own autobiography here a little bit. Okay, now this is the book that makes C.S. Lewis famous. Because of the Screwtape Letters, Lewis becomes a celebrity outside of Oxford. Okay. Soon now, his picture is going to be on the cover of Time magazine. Okay. He will then be asked to go on the BBC, that's the British Broadcasting Company, during World War II, to give talks on Christianity, to provide moral and spiritual support as London was paralyzed in fear of the Blitzkrieg, you know, the London bombings, you know. That is something, by the way, I can't imagine happening today. BBC is not Christian radio, it's just radio, you know, and they're asking a Christian to come on and talk about Christianity, to give support morally to war times, you know. I can't see the media today doing that. That's how far we've come. Anyhow, those talks he gives on the BBC are then pulled together, and they become the book Mere Christianity. But it is Screwtape Letters that puts Lewis on that trajectory for all this to happen. There's a chapter in a biography of Lewis by Ellen Jacobs, pretty good biography, called The Narnian. And the chapter is entitled, Nobody Could Put Lewis Down. See, and that says it perfectly. After the Screwtape Letters, everybody was reading C.S. Lewis. The Screwtape Letters sold like hotcakes. It was a runaway bestseller. 8 printings in the first year. Okay. Lewis becomes associated with this book. So the farmer in Nebraska, the only thing he knows about C.S. Lewis, he's the man who wrote these letters from one devil to another devil. Okay. And people would come up to C.S. Lewis and they would say, oh, you're the devil man. See, he became known as the devil man. Okay. Now, fame brings both blessing and curse. The blessing, never again will C.S. Lewis have to worry about getting something published. That's the blessing. But the curse is fame brought new demands upon his time which he could not possibly meet. C.S. Lewis has to adjust to fame. And it is a big adjustment. Okay? This prompts him to hire his brother, Warney, to be a paid Bill Gruber, office person. Okay. And do you get paid for it? He warned he got paid for it. Okay. So Warney will be at Lewis's side until he dies. He'll always be there now. The Screwtape letters triggered an avalanche of fan mail from all over the world, from Britain, Europe, Canada, in the United States, and Lewis could not possibly keep up with this. So from here on in, Warney actually answers most of the mail, a lot of the fan mail especially. So the Screwtape letters in many ways changed the daily routine of Lewis's life. Now, most people I find love the Screwtape letters. They just, that's a good read, you know. However, not everybody liked the book. Scholars did not like it generally, especially his fellow Oxford dons. They did not like this book, and they hated C.S. Lewis for writing it. Now, from their perspective, they are going, Clyde Staples Lewis, you are a scholar, you are a professor at one of the most prestigious universities, you know, in the world. Something more academic, something much more scholarly should have brought you notoriety. And it was really a source of irritation that a fantasy brought him notoriety. And they already were irritated at him that he had written science fiction, a professor writing the science fiction and being a Christian apologist. But this was too much. One of his colleagues at the university wrote an editorial, stuck it in the paper, and they accused Lewis of pandering to the lowest tastes of the common folk to acquire popularity for himself. I find that grossly, you know, unfair. Okay. But anyhow, I think one reason they did not like this book or Lewis writing it was I think in some of the chapters Lewis is subtly exposing their intellectual dishonesty and poking a couple holes in their arguments against Christianity. But anyhow, not everybody loves this book. Okay. It might also surprise you to learn that though we enjoy reading it, C.S. Lewis did not enjoy writing it. He was glad when it was done. And he said, never again. Never again am I going to write letters like this. Okay? Now, you try it. In fact, a lot of people have tried this. There's all sorts of spin-offs on this. There's a book out, Emails from Screwtape, by Jim Forrest, you know. And I did one at the seminary. I had to write a paper on the doctrine of the church for a professor. And so I pretended like I was Screwtape saying something. But in order to do it, you have to get in the shoes of the devil, and you have to actually try to think like a devil would think how to approach something, and it really is taxing, you know, on the mind that way. Anyhow, Lewis makes many comments why he was depressed writing these. He says, here it is. The work into which I had to project myself while I spoke through Screwtape was all dust, grit, thirst, and itch. Every trace of beauty, freshness, and genealogy had to be excluded. It almost smothered me before I was done. Okay, so the strain of writing these gave him a spiritual cramp. And he said all the while he wrote these, he was devoid of joy. And that's not surprising. I mean, the devil's the great joy sapper. He tears everything, you know, apart. Though Lewis didn't like writing them, I think we can be grateful that he stuck to it. Because one of the best ways to combat the devil is to know his tactics. You always have to know the strategy of the enemy. See, that's a rule of warfare. Lewis had actually planned on writing a sequel, but it never came to be. He said, never again. Okay. You know what the sequel was going to be? He was planning on writing a series of letters from one angel to another angel on how to shield the believer from the temptations of the evil one. Okay. I wish he had written that. Okay. There was one exception. In 1959, just 4 years before he dies, Lewis writes, Screwtape proposes a toast. But this is not exactly a letter. This is Screwtape, the senior devil, giving an after-dinner speech at the Tempter's Training College for Young Demons. Okay. And what Lewis is doing here, this one is more political in nature, but Lewis is criticizing trends in modern Great Britain, and especially Lewis is criticizing modern education, which was a favorite target or subject of his that we often neglect about C.S. Lewis. But anyhow, when Screwtape is giving this after-dinner speech, Screwtape, you know, the devil, he's praising modern education and its leveling effect. And, of course, that is exactly what C.S. Lewis deplores. Okay. Anyhow, if you buy a copy of the Screwtape letters today, usually you will find Screwtape proposes the toast in the back as an appendix. But it actually was written 18 years later. Okay. Now we want to finally get to reading a few things from the Screwtape letters, and when you go to read this, you constantly have to remind yourself that everything is in reverse. Lewis said that to read it, it's like looking at a photographic negative. Screwtape's white is our black. His black is our white. What he praises, we deplore. What he recommends, we should not. Everything is in reverse. So when Screwtape says to Wormwood, our enemy, this is God. You've got to think God. This is the devil talking. God is the devil's enemy. Everything's in reverse. When he says, our Father below. Okay, who's that? Okay. This is not our Father who art in heaven. Our Father below is devil number one. Okay. So everything's in reverse, and you constantly gotta, you know, sort of keep that there. Sometimes Lewis will make little puns. Oh, when he puts things in reverse, though I don't know if readers always, you know, catch it. You can take the prefix higher, H-I-E-R, like in hierarchy. Okay. Higher actually means sacred, so a hierarchy is a religious structure of authority. Okay. Only as a pun does higher have anything to do with height. Like, that book is higher than I can reach. Now it has to do with Heiser. Okay. So, when Screwtape is talking about the structure of hell, and he speaks about the skilled, polished, the best devils as being farther down in the lower archy. See, in the lower archy. Okay. One clergyman read this, and he didn't get it, that this is in reverse. But he reads it, and he promptly canceled his subscription to the Guardian, and he said because of the advice that Wormwood is getting from Screwtape is not only erroneous, it's diabolical. well, of course it is. You know, this is the devil, you know, talking here. Okay, he wrote these in 1941. What's happening in 1941? Okay, Pearl Harbor. Europe is now engulfed in World War II. It's been since 1939, and World War II is escalating. The bombings now on London and so forth. So, World War II is mentioned a number of times in the Screwtape letters. In fact, World War II provides sort of a backdrop for these letters. The first one we're going to read is one of the letters, and it's all about the war, because the war is raging when Lewis writes these. Okay? Now let me preface it with a few remarks about C.S. Lewis and the war. C.S. Lewis himself had fought in the First World War, and he had been wounded and honorably discharged. His very good friend, Paddy Moore, had been killed in the trench warfare in the First World War, and that's how Lewis came to take care of his mother, Mrs. Moore. Lewis never talked about the war, and people knew not to talk about it. Memories of the First War haunted his dreams for years. Okay. Now, Hitler was on the march, and though C.S. Lewis knew that Hitler is evil, and though he knew that Germany's ambition was strong, and though he knew that they were morally obligated to push Germany back, still, Lewis was not looking forward to this war. He just doesn't have to be. Okay. I think he has a case of deja vu. Here we go again. Okay? But the war is a personal issue for C.S. Lewis. He had seen the horror of war. Okay? By the way, we want to go down a little side trail real quick here on the war. Right now there's a lot of talk about anti-Semitism with the Israeli-Hamas, you know, conflict that way. It's often said that people outside of Germany did not know of Hitler's treatment of the Jews. That's not true. And C.S. Lewis is a good example. Okay. In 1933, which is before the war, but Hitler's on the rise, okay, Lewis writes a letter to his lifelong friend, Arthur Graves, and in that letter, Lewis mentions the iniquity of Hitler's persecution of the Jews, and he calls it inexcusable. Lewis knew about it. This is before the war, and he's in England. I mean, how did he find out about it? I mean, people knew about it. Lewis has a friend by the name of Tolkien. You all know Tolkien, the Hobbit man, okay, the Lord of the Rings, okay. Tolkien was very instrumental in C.S. Lewis's conversion. And Lewis and Tolkien were often together as part of the Inklings. It was a kind of a Socratic club that would meet at the pub and they would share their papers and so forth. Well, anyhow, Tolkien's The Hobbit was slated to be translated into German by a German publishing house. But they put it on hold because the publisher was worried that maybe Tolkien was a Jewish name. And they started an investigation, and Tolkien replied with a strongly worded letter. And in the letter, Tolkien says, no, Tolkien is not Jewish. And then he says, if I am to understand that you are inquiring whether I am of Jewish origin, I can only reply that I regret that I appear to have no ancestors of that gifted people. And if inquiries of this sort are to become the rule, then the time is not far away when a German name will no longer be a source of pride. Ooh, that took courage. Give us courage for the facing of this hour. Okay, Lewis sees the onset of World War II as, here comes more horror. It's like you're going to sleep and you know you're going to have the nightmare again. Okay? But C.S. Lewis is a Christian, and so he found himself bound to ask whether God, in his redemptive purposes, might bring some good out of all this misery. So without in any way minimizing the horror of war, without denying it, Lewis begins to ask questions that will put the war in both a smaller and larger context. In the smaller context, he's going to ask, can an ordinary person grow in virtue or fall into sin as a result of a warlike situation? In the larger context, he's going to ask, what might this war mean in light of eternity? Okay, so whenever he mentions the war in the Screwtape letters, it's in one of those two contexts. Okay, let's take a look at the first one. Now, a little background about this first quote here. It's on page 9. Wormwood, now remember, he's the junior double. He's the one that's not polished, okay? He's still learning, okay? Wormwood has expressed absolutely delight at the commencement, you know, of the hostilities, and Wormwood has just been rubbing his hands in glee at this war. These are the devils. They delight in seeing us destroyed. The devils hate us. They hate anything God has made. So he has just been giddy at seeing orphans and widows and churches destroyed. You know, he's just giddy over this war. Well, in this letter, Screwtape is writing Wormwood, and he reminds Wormwood, you're still an amateur. You're inexperienced. You don't quite know how to assess things. And Screwtape here is warning him in this letter not to expect too much from a war. Let's read it. Okay, now again, this is not all of it, just a few slices of the letter. My dear Wormwood, it is a little disappointing to expect a detailed report on your work and to receive instead such a vague rhapsody as your last letter. You say you are delirious with joy because the European humans have started another of their wars. I see very well what has happened to you. You are not delirious. You are only drunk. I must warn you not to hope too much from a war. Of course a war is entertaining. The immediate fear and suffering of the humans is a legitimate and pleasing refreshment for our myriads of toiling workers. But what permanent good does it do us unless we make use of it for bringing souls to our Father below? When I see the temporal suffering of humans who finally escape us, I feel as if I had been allowed to taste the first course of a rich banquet and then denied the rest. It is worse than not to have tasted it at all. Let us therefore think rather how to use than how to enjoy this European war. For it has certain tendencies inherent in it which are in themselves by no means in our favor. We may hope for a good deal of cruelty and unchastity, but if we are not careful, we shall see thousands turning in this tribulation to the enemy, while tens of thousands who do not go so far as that will nevertheless have their attention diverted from themselves to values and causes which they believe to be higher than the self. Consider, too, what undesirable deaths occur in wartime. Men are killed in places where they knew they might be killed and to which they go if they are at all of the enemy's party prepared. How much better for us if all humans died in costly nursing homes amid doctors who lie, nurses who lie, friends who lie, as we have trained them, promising life to the dying, encouraging the belief that sickness excuses every indulgence, and even, if our workers know their job, withholding all suggestion of a priest, lest it should betray to the sick man his true condition. And how disastrous for us is the continual remembrance of death which war enforces. One of our best weapons, contented worldliness, is rendered useless. In wartime, not even a human can believe that he's going to live forever. Okay, so you can start to see the sly, clever tricks here of the Screwtape. He knows that, you know, in a wartime when you're surrounded by death, you know, that people will be awakened to their mortality. They might start to spiritually even prepare themselves for death, and that means that they might go over to our enemy. They might be converted, you know, to Christ, and that is the very last thing they want to happen. Okay? So the war may not be in our favor, you know, with that goal in mind. Now, when you read the letters, the topics are many. One letter will be about tea room manners. One will be about formal philosophy, fads and fashions, irritable little habits, doctrinal disputes. But whatever the topic, Screwtape's advice to Wormwood is always the same. Never forget our aim. We are aiming at the capture and the destruction of the human soul to lead the person away from God in Christ and Christian truth. So yeah, the war may be entertaining. We inflict a lot of destruction on them, but if we don't keep them in our camp, we lost. See? Okay. Okay, let's go to a second one. Let's leave the war for a little while. Okay, we'll go to a second one. In many of the letters, Screwtape is constantly teaching Wormwood, but do use what is in our favor, and what is in our favor is the culture. as Western society has become since the Enlightenment. Okay? Exploit that. That's to your advantage, he tells Wormwood. Okay? Now, one thing about modern society is people no longer believe in a devil. Or at least they don't believe in him seriously. They reduce him to a comical figure carrying a pitchfork and wearing red tights. You know, people don't take it seriously. Screwtape is going to tell Wormwood, take advantage, that's in our favor. Okay. So in one letter, he will explain, our current diabolical policy is to keep patients ignorant of the existence of devils. Okay. Now, if they come to believe in the existence of devils, well, then we're going to have to change our strategy with those patients. But by and large, you know, the policy is keep them ignorant of the existence of devils. We can get a lot of mileage, you know, that way. Okay. I used to collect cartoons, theological cartoons. I have this one cartoon, and it shows God approaching Adam and Eve in the garden. In the first frame, Adam says to God, you can hardly blame me, Lord. It's that woman thou gavest me. In the second frame, you see the woman, and she's saying to God, you can hardly blame me, Lord. The devil made me do it. And then in the last frame, the devil is saying to God, and you can hardly blame me, Lord. After all, modern theology has shown that I don't even exist. we make it very easy, you know, on the devil. When Lewis was writing these letters, and in the years after these letters, C.S. Lewis said that the most common question he got was, do you really believe in the devil? He said he got that question all the time. A lot of people, they started reading these, and it was just fun and entertaining. Lewis is dead serious. Yeah, he's dead serious with this. You know, this is, he's doing Christian theology in reverse here, you know. This prompts Lewis to write a preface to the Screwtape letters. In that preface, he states that he accepts the traditional classical Christian doctrine on the devil. Okay? And it's only a page or two, but it's sort of a very concise summary of who the devil is. And if you sort of get confused, where did the devil come from? Is the devil God's equal opposite? Better be careful with that one. Okay, no. I say no, no. Okay. But it's a good little summary about the devil, where he comes from, you know. But Lewis accepts that. He believes in the devil that way. Okay, let's do number two. Now, number two is an example where Screwtape is telling Wormwood, this is in the air, everybody breathes, it's in our favor, exploit it for demonic purposes. Okay, number two. Remember again, this is Screwtape talking, everything's in reverse. Okay. Only the learned read old books, and we have now so dealt with the learned that they are of all men the least likely to acquire wisdom by doing so. We have done this by inculcating the historical point of view. The historical point of view, put briefly, means that when a learned man is presented with any statement in an ancient author, the one question he never asks is whether it is true. To regard the ancient writer as a possible source of knowledge, to anticipate that what he said could possibly modify your thoughts or your behavior, this would be rejected as unutterably simple-minded. And since we cannot deceive the whole human race all the time, it is most important thus to cut every generation off from all others. So the devil wants us to become just sort of marooned, you know, in the present, okay, and not and disregard the wisdom of the past. Okay. So what C.S. Lewis calls the historical point of view, he believes exerts titanic influence over people today. Now maybe an example of the historical point of view. Let's say you're reading something by an ancient writer, maybe Ignatius in the second century. Okay. And Ignatius writes of the resurrection and the hope of the resurrection. Yeah. Now, if you are influenced and if you're under the spell of the historical point of view, you will read Ignatius and you will not ask, is it true, that of which he writes the resurrection? You're just going to assume that it's not true. Okay? Instead, you will ask, not is it true, but why does he believe that it is true? Oh, he must have been influenced by Eastern mystery religions, or he must have been influenced by the Persians, and that's why he writes it. Okay? So, you don't really have to ever ask, is it true? You just always explain why somebody, you know, believes that. Okay, so the historical point of view for Lewis is one of the ways that we insulate ourselves from possible wisdom from our ancestors. Okay? Lewis calls this chronological snobbery, when we think that only the present moment can speak truth. Okay, now I see this all the time, that we're having a lot of talk about gender, sex changes, and all this stuff, you know, and I've seen it already happen where, you know, ancient wisdom is not allowed to enter the conversation. Only the present moment can now talk. See, we cut ourselves off from the past. So sometimes Lewis's colleagues, they would dismiss Lewis and say, that's Victorian. Okay, and Lewis would say, and you're chronological snobs. You think only this present moment can speak truth. Okay. I had this happen once. Many, many years ago, I had a group of college students at Center College, and we were meeting every other week and stuff, and I forget how it happened, but some of us sort of, we put forward the Christian teaching on sex that is for the bounds of marriage between a man and a wife, nothing extramarital or premarital, etc., you know. And one of the guys, he says, well, that's old-fashioned. I didn't know what to say off the top of my head. You know, I don't know what to say. But I said, no, it's not old-fashioned. It's eternal. I mean, just to call something Victorian or old-fashioned, that doesn't say anything at all about, you know, whether, you know, it is true. But anyhow, in the Screwtape Letters, the diabolical purpose of the historical point of view is to remove questions of truth and falsehood from the patient's mind. So in the very first letter, Screwtape teaches Wormwood, okay, use what's in our favor, and he says, your patient, he's modern, and that means he doesn't really believe that doctrines are true or false. He thinks they're outworn or contemporary. And so Screwtape says, jargon,
not argument, is your best way to keep him from the enemy, from God. Okay, jargon. Okay, anyhow, in another letter, Screwtape is very proud that inroads to indifference to truth has found their way into the church. Okay. How are we doing here for time? Okay, let's do this real quickly. Let me just run you real quick through the book, and then I'll show you how the book ends and show you something really neat, how the book ends. Okay? At the very start of Screwtape Letters, Wormwood's patient is not a Christian. Not very far into the letters, and his patient becomes a Christian. This gets Wormwood a black mark and a scolding from Screwtape. But Screwtape tells Wormwood, but all is not lost. Even though he's become a Christian, still we have all sorts of tricks up our sleeve. Okay. And you'll go on for several letters. And then this Christian patient, he begins to experience dryness of soul. Okay. Now, every Christian in his Christian walk will go through periods, sometimes very long periods, of dryness of soul. Okay. I think it's letter 8. If you have dryness of soul, you might want to read that chapter, but just remember you're reading it in reverse. Okay? But how you might want to regard that dryness of soul. Okay? For a while, the patient will drift away from the faith. He will hang out with those who scoff at the faith. But then one day, he is awakened to a fresh encounter with God. Then one day, Wormwood has had to give the bad news to Screwtape that his patient has fallen in love with a fine Christian girl, and she has already introduced him to her family. Now the patient has a wall of Christian friends around him. This is going to make it all the harder for the devils to get him away from God. Notice what C.S. Lewis is doing. He's telling you in reverse, okay, how important Christian company is for the support of the faith. He's telling it in reverse, okay? So go it alone, and what happens? Most people just drift into that shallow thing Lewis calls my religion. Okay. All is not lost. He's surrounded by a wall of Christian friends, and Screwtape will tell Wormwood, but okay, here's what you do now. Okay. Turn him into a good little Pharisee. Okay. He's got all sorts of tactics. Okay. One of my favorite letters is letter number 12, which gives us one of the best zingers in the Screwtape letters. This will be number 3. Wormwood here he's amateurish, he's not experienced, so Wormwood is very anxious to tempt his patient to spectacular sins. He tries to get his patient to do to extravagantly wicked and deplorable things, and Screwtape now writes him in this letter and says, but that may not be the best strategy. He recommends a more quiet, subtle approach. Let's do number 3. You will say that these are very small sins, and doubtless, like all young tempters, you are anxious to be able to report spectacular wickedness. But do remember, The only thing that matters is the extent to which you separate the man from the enemy. See, there it is again. That's the main thing. It does not matter how small the sins are, provided that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and out into the nothing. Murder is no better than cards if cards can do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts. Does that ring true? Okay. Okay, a few things to watch for if you want to read the Screwtape letters. Virtually in every letter, you will detect Screwtape's hatred and scorn for humanity. The devil hates us. He hates anything that God has made and seeks only to rip it apart. Okay? In one of the letters, Screwtape will refer to us as those hairless bipeds. Okay? He calls the girl that the patient falls in love with the filthy, insipid little prude. See? In one of the letters, you will get the gospel. But the gospel, of course, is in reverse. And Screwtape is aghast at God's love for humanity. It is number 4. For we must never forget what is most repellent and inexplicable trait in our enemy. He really loves the hairless bipeds he has created and always gives back to them with his right hand what he has taken away with his left. Okay, now here's how the book ends. Maybe I shouldn't spoil it. But in the very last letter, the patient has been killed in a World War II bombing. And just before he dies, he recognizes Wormwood for what he is. Then he breathes his last and he goes to the new life promised to the redeemed. Screwtape goes ballistic. He has an agony of rage. They let him get away. They lost. Wormwood is severely punished. Screwtape has addressed all of his letters, "My dear Wormwood," but in this last one, he gets sarcastic. My very dear Wormwood, my puppet, my pixney. Now, the hostility is not surprising. The first time I read the Screwtape letters, I didn't really catch it. But through the letters, there has been jockeying for position and advantage between Screwtape and Wormwood. There's been friction, constant friction between them. Wormwood has gotten blamed for everything that goes wrong with the patient. Screwtape has no patience at all, you know, with Wormwood's immaturity. Wormwood, in turn, he sometimes will complain to Screwtape about the advice that he has given. On one occasion, Wormwood even turned Screwtape in to the secret police in hell and showed them some of the things that he was advising. Okay. So, now I sort of see it. At least I think that's what you're supposed to see. That though they are united in a common cause, they are not united in love. How can they be? This is hell, where everyone is imprisoned in oneself, in competition always with one another. If you want the unity of love, you have to gain heaven, because God is love.